Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Merry Christmas and welcome along to this week's edition of Unbelievable. It is, if you hadn't already noticed, our Christmas weekend edition of the show with me, Justin Briley, and Ruth Jackson. Welcome along, Ruth. Happy Christmas to you.
Happy Christmas to you, Justin.
Oh, well, we're all feeling in a very Christmassy mood today. Not your usual kind of show. We're not doing a dialogue debate type format on Unbelievable today. We've got more of a smorgasbord of different items, a look back at the year, some interesting interviews with various people and their faith journeys. We'll tell you all about it in a moment's time. But if you want more from the show, as ever, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable for the show page. You can find the archive of shows spanning many, many years and indeed links to our newsletter, video channel and more besides. Tell me, what does Christmas look like for you, Ruth? What's your favourite thing about Christmas?
Oh, there's so many favourite things. It's really hard to whittle it down to one thing. I think because I grew up as a vicar's kid, so Christmas was always quite busy in our house, but it was also an amazing opportunity for us to spend quality time with friends and family. And we sort of had a tradition in our house of inviting everyone into our house that didn't have anywhere to go at Christmas, whether that was someone in the congregation, someone that my dad just met on the street. So it was always really loud and quite fun in our house. And my little sister's birthday is the day before yours, actually, Justin, because you're a Christmas Eve baby. She's a Christmas Eve Eve baby. So it was always packed, but really fun. And unfortunately, we've not been able to do that this year. We've not been able to invite random people into our house. But hopefully next year, the tradition will continue of reaching out into the community and welcoming everyone in at Christmas.
Yeah, it obviously has been very different this year. I mean, people have often said, oh, doesn't your birthday always get overshadowed by Christmas, Justin, being on Christmas Eve? But actually, I've always quite enjoyed the holiday atmosphere, the kind of the fun around my birthday. So I was never at school on my birthday, which is one advantage. Christmas for me is definitely, you know, about the opportunity to spend time with family. I love just, we're fortunate to have an open fire in our house. And so we love at Christmas to put some logs on the fire, make it feel all snug and cozy, turn the lights down, have the Christmas tree on, watch, you know, classic Christmas film like Home Alone or something like that. And it just feels, you can't beat that feeling, can you? So
you really can't. I think one of the other things as well is just stuffing your face with food that's really bad for you, that for some reason you would never eat any other time of year, but you sort of eat your body weight at Christmas.
Yeah, and then promise you'll work it all off in the new year with that New Year's resolution. Well, welcome along to our Unbelievable Christmas special for 2020. Very different Christmas for everyone in 2020, but we hope that what we've got today on the show is going to inspire, challenge, bless you in some way or another. As ever, you can get in touch with the show as well, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. If you want to email Ruth and myself, or indeed find us on social media at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. And all of those links and more, again, available from our webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. We're going to be hearing later on in the show some really interesting stories of people who have found faith, partially through Unbelievable, other means as well. We're going to hear Ailey's story, Jim's story. But tell us about Nick Page, our first guest on the show today, Ruth.
Yeah, so Nick Page is a really funny guy. He's a broadcaster, an author. He's written over 70 books, which is quite remarkable. But his newest book is called Christmas Tradition, Truth and Total Baubles. And he kind of unpicks some of the things that we have assumed are part of the Christmas story. Some of the traditions, things around Santa Claus, And he sort of unpicks some of it and talks about the myth versus the heart of the story. So I caught up with him to ask him some of the things that he discovered while he was writing the book. Nick, first of all, what inspired you to write a Christmas book?
Well, I was interested in the history of Christmas, and I think I was annoyed as much as anything else. I am a person who is slightly fueled by outrage and grumpiness. You know, it was basically, there's so much, as I call them, baubles talked about, you know, Christmas in terms of Christmas having pagan origins and stuff like that. And when you actually look at it, you realise most of it doesn't stand up. So although it's a book about the whole history of Christmas, you know, lots of different stuff and everything from, you know, the food and drink to the carol services. That was the origins. It was really trying to sort of stop people spreading a lot of what I call festive fake news.
Well, we'll come to some of the things that you discovered and some of the myths that you kind of debunk throughout the book. But why is Christmas so important to you?
Well, I think it's partly the time of year. You know, I mean, actually, one of the things I challenge is this idea that Jesus is the reason for the season, which is what Christians often say. I actually think it's a slightly bit bigger than that. I mean, obviously, as a Christian, if you think Jesus is the creative force, then Jesus is the reason for everything. But, you know, anyway, leaving that aside, human beings have always had a kind of celebration in midwinter. And I think it's really, really important at this time of year, you know, when around the winter solstice, when the days are at their darkest, that we celebrate. So there's something actually fundamentally human about religion and about celebrating in those times. And I think that's partly why Christians, when they first tried to decide on a date for Christmas, chose that time of year. It wasn't that they were nicking another festival. It's just what better time of year to celebrate the coming of light than in the midst of the darkness.
What's your favourite thing about Christmas?
That is a really hard thing. I think, if I'm honest, I think my favourite thing about Christmas is nostalgia, which seems an odd thing to say, but it's kind of like I remember so well the Christmases of my youth as a child and how much I loved them, not just the presents, but getting together with the family. And I still love all that stuff. But I think that it's that actually it's all the memories around Christmas and, you know, and what that means for us as family, really.
I'd imagine that's probably quite a lot of people's favourite thing as well, isn't it? There's something about Christmas that just evokes lots of memories, the smells and things like that, isn't there?
And I think that's really why people have felt so passionately about it this year, is because that's kind of under threat. It's not so much, you know, we can have presents and we can do all the spending and you can have the same amount of food, but actually it's the getting together, it's the whole atmosphere, it's the tradition around it. Family tradition and society's traditions.
And you looked into lots of traditions, obviously, to research this book. What are some of the strangest things that you came across?
Oh, well, I mean, there's lots of oddities. I suppose the actual strangest thing about Christmas is Santa Claus, really, when we think about it. That is the absolute oddest thing, that the origin of Santa Claus is, of course, with a 4th century bishop in Turkey, you know, or what is now Turkey, who was probably martyred. And somehow that person over the centuries has become Saint Nicholas and then become a person dressed in red who does some very dodgy things around chimney stacks, you know. you know, so it's really weird because actually the Victorian Santa Claus, the way that he's portrayed in like 1823 and the night before Christmas, he's really an elf. He's become a sort of strange figure. So I think Santa Claus is without doubt the weirdest thing about Christmas.
And what are some of those myths that you debunk in your book? What are some of the things that, you know, have just sort of slipped into our consciousness of that is definitely true of Christmas, and some of the things that you very much pull apart in the book?
Well, I mean, there's two kinds of things, really. There is this common thing that goes around that Christmas was originally a pagan festival and that Christians somehow nicked it. And in fact, actually, as I look at it in the book, and all that, I can't go into the detail of the history here because it's quite detailed, but there's absolutely no evidence for that at all. In fact, it's more likely the other way, more likely that the pagan festival of the sun was stolen because it was placed at that time because the Christians already had a festival there. So there's a whole lot of pagan myths about it, you know, and like the Christmas tree is a pagan symbol. Well, actually, it probably originates in Adam and Eve mystery plays done in the sort of 14th century, 15th century. So it's actually Christian as well. So there's those kinds of myths. And then actually, to be honest, there's myths that Christians spread around Christmas, and not intentionally, but you know, all the stuff about there being a stable or three kings or all that kind of stuff. I mean, even a donkey is not mentioned in the original story. So, you know, everybody invents sort of details that go around it.
And Jesus wasn't even born in winter, was he?
Well, nobody knows. I mean, one of the things, one of the problems they had with the early church was, firstly, they weren't very keen on birthdays. Birthdays were seen as sort of pagan things that you didn't really celebrate. Secondly, nobody knew when he was born. I mean, Clement of Alexandria, writing about in the 3rd century, sort of thought maybe it was March, maybe it was May. He settled for November. Nobody knew. And so, you know, we still don't know. The Gospels don't really give us any clues. They say that shepherds were out in the fields, which would actually indicate sometime between March and November. But you've got to place it somewhere. If you're going to celebrate a birthday, you've got to place it somewhere. So for symbolic reasons, you know, midwinter works well, I think.
And why do you think stables become such a key thing? Because obviously when you think of a nativity scene, it's pretty much always encased in a stable, isn't it? Where's that come from and why do we do that?
It's probably come from Renaissance paintings and from depictions of it. And the reason we do it is because it's our culture. So there's no mention of a stable in the gospel stories. There is a mention of a manger. Now, in first century Roman province of Palestine, mangers were inside the houses. So they weren't actually outside. Nobody had a stable outside. But obviously for Renaissance Christians trying to reimagine it, when they hear manger, they think stables. So it's really a reflection of our culture. That's really all that's happened, is that we've I think the word is enculturated it, which is fine. You know, I mean, the Bible allows you, in a sense, to do that, as long as you're not sort of building some massive theology on it and, you know, excommunicating people for not believing it. It's okay, I think.
And you mentioned there that birthdays weren't really a big thing for Christians or even for sort of, yeah, people back in the olden days, for want of a better word. Do you think that's one of the reasons that Christians didn't really celebrate Christmas as much as they did, say, Easter? Easter was much more important festival for them, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Christmas is really fourth importance, if that, in the early for the early church. So Easter was the big one, and then you had Pentecost, and then you had the sort of period between the two, and Lent was added. And then in the East they had a festival called Epiphany, which we still celebrate, some of us still celebrate, which is on the 6th of January, which was sort of tied up with the birth. And it's only Christmas comes after that. And yes, there was a very strong anti-birthday kind of thing, largely because it was actually the death day that was much important. So much more important for the early church. For example, if you were martyred, that was the day of your commemoration, you know, and I suppose it is a kind of birthday. You're born into glory. But, you know, the thing was, they didn't really celebrate birthdays. Birthdays were sort of pagan rulers. Even in the Bible, who celebrates birthday? Herod, when he kills John the Baptist. Pharaoh, you know, in the story of Joseph. So really they didn't like the idea of birthdays very much, but such was the pressure and such was the eventual sort of demand to settle on a date that they had to choose one.
You mention in your book that to a certain extent all traditions have to be invented in the first place. Do you think it matters if some of those traditions aren't real in some senses, if we've kind of built these traditions around a story, or do you think it's really important that we get right to the heart of the story and just stick to that?
I think it depends what you're using the story for. Christianity is embedded in story. That's something we don't often accept. We like to think it's embedded in theology and doctrine, but it's not actually. All that grows out of stories, narratives in the Bible, really. And what is embedded in the Gospels is a story. So, of course, story is important. I think if belief in the story, in the historical facts of it, becomes something that you're actually going to use as you'll weaponize against people, as it were, then I think you've got it wrong. Ultimately, all traditions have to be invented, and ultimately, they all tell a kind of story. I mean, the church year, for example, tells the story of Jesus, and they help us engage with it. I think stories are tremendously important, and, you know, they're part of being human, and that's why we sort of embed them in these traditions.
And in some ways, we are desperate for a good news story, aren't we, at the moment, in the midst of everything that's going on. How do we, do you think, share the Christmas story with a world that is so devoid of hope at the moment?
I mean, one of the ways we talk about Christmas with non-Christians is to welcome them into it, you know, to share it with them. And it is a sacred and a secular festival. It always has been. And so, you know, I know some Christians get very harumphy about the whole thing, but, you know, as if they shouldn't be allowed unless you're a card-carrying member. But everybody's allowed to do it. And the other thing is, I think, to really emphasise that Christmas is a story of hope. of incarnation, of welcome, of the Son of God being born into an ordinary household, of it being a sign for all of us. And of course, this year of all years, we need a bit of light in the darkness. We need a bit of hope in times of hardship. And so to really keep telling the story, keep living it. Don't worry, you know, old curmudgeons like me turn up and go, well, it wasn't really like that, blah, 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 blah. But let's keep telling this story because it is absolutely wonderful.
And finally, this show is going to be going out on Christmas Day. So hopefully, depending on whoever's allowed at our house, we're going to be opening crackers, sharing Christmas jokes. So it feels like it would be remiss of me to not ask you for your favourite Christmas joke, Nick.
Oh, I really don't do jokes. I mean, I'm a terrible joke teller. And so I don't have them. But I'm sure whatever you pull out of your Christmas cracker will be absolutely hilarious because they always are. We know that.
Well, there we go. Send us in your best jokes, people. Nick Page, thank you so much. How do we get a hold of your book?
Well, you go to any reputable bookseller, and I would urge you this year of all years, maybe choose an independent local one. It's called Christmas Tradition, Truth and Total Baubles, and it should be widely available, I hope.
Brilliant. Well, Nick Page, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to speak to you, and happy Christmas.
And to you.
What a great interview. Nick's such an interesting guy. And like you say, 70 books. I wish I could write the way Nick does, because I'm struggling to get my own book written. It's only number two, certainly nowhere near number 70. Anyway, he's actually featured in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine. And it's an article that picks up a lot of what was being talked about there. I found some really interesting stuff, though, in their December edition that he's written about, like Christmas trees. Apparently, they're not from all these sort of pagan roots that people often claim, but they're more associated with special plays that took place in the 14th and 15th century, when on the 24th of December, Adam and Eve's Day was celebrated. Mm. And they did sort of plays that were taken through the streets and things. And of course, if you're doing a play about Adam and Eve, you need a tree. And in winter, the best trees to use are evergreen. And that was where it all started, apparently, according to Nick Page. So you can get that, actually, Premier Christianity's December edition, free sample copy over at premierchristianity.com/free sample. But yeah, it's amazing what we sort of sometimes pick up about Christmas, some of the myths and realities of Christmas, isn't it, Ruth?
Yeah, it is. And I think the fact that we assume so much of it is pagan, but actually that's what I loved about Nick's interview, was he sort of said that actually a lot of the things that we assume are pagan actually have Christian roots if you go back to the heart of it. And yeah, also his point that in some ways it doesn't really matter, actually. The power of the story of Christmas and light overcoming darkness in some ways overshadows all of those, the sort of peripheral issues, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've got a really interesting discussion coming up next week on the show on Tolkien, and that's a discussion really on obviously the Lord of the Rings, the Christian influences in his writing. And Tolkien and Lewis, you know, his great friend in Oxford, were both fully aware of all the kind of myths, you know, of history that kind of had brought us up to the 20th century. And the fact that obviously there were themes that resonated from pagan culture wasn't in any way a concern to them. It was simply, as they called it, you know, they prefigured the true myth, the true reality of what Jesus brought in. So it's no surprise. I don't get concerned, you know, when, you know, my secular humanist friends say, oh, but, you know, Christmas has always been about light in the darkness and, you know, finding comfort in dark times. I'm like, yeah, of course it has, because we're living through a winter period. But that does not stop the Christian story being true too, that it kind of brings, you know, this reality of light into darkness in that sense. But anyway, I'm wittering on, and it's time we heard from someone else. We've got Ailey. We both sat down to talk with Ailey recently, who's a student in Scotland. She's got a really interesting story that connects with the show over the past year. So let's hear from her. Well, next up on the show, we're joined by Ailey. Ailey is a fairly recent listener to Unbelievable and viewer of the videos, but she got in touch earlier this year to tell us a little bit about her story. And I've been a little bit involved, and it's been quite exciting to see the journey Ailey has been on already in this past year. An unusual year in lots of ways. but especially significant for Ailey this past year. So Ailey, welcome along to the programme. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
It's great. You're coming to us from university, where you've sort of been in self-isolation with people in your house or your flat, haven't you, for the last several weeks?
Yes, it has been quite strange this year, but we're coming to the end, coming to Christmas.
Yeah, I'm sure we're all looking to, you know, some of the restrictions being lifted at least a little bit over the Christmas period. Take us back, Ailey, because when did you first bump into the Unbelievable show itself, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, over the lockdown period, to start with, I had quite like a lot of people. I was like, oh, I'll keep up hobbies and make the most of the extra time. But there was a point in lockdown where I started getting totally bombarded by questions that kept going around my mind of who is Jesus and why am I doing this? What is the meaning of life? And which seems like quite big questions. And I had thought about Christianity before and kind of been in contact with it online. But it was at this point I found Unbelievable, and it put the Christianity I was being like totally bugged about in the best way possible.
Where was this sort of questions coming from? I mean, you didn't come from a particularly religious household, did you, yourself?
No, I didn't. I did go, one of my best friends in school went to church with her mum on a Sunday, and we used to go to the Scripture Union school lunchtime club, and there I kind of heard about stories of the Bible, and I was genuinely interested, even though I did come from a non-Christian family. And there was one day in high school at this club that a guy came in from a Christian organization, and he shared his testimony of how he went from being a drug addict and how Jesus totally turned his life around. And I remember him saying that he put the crown of his life on Jesus. And in that moment, that made sense to me. And it felt like that was the only reasonable thing for me to do myself.
So you'd had this kind of some experiences, some things that, but essentially you weren't particular churchgoer, as I understand it, yourself. I mean, what sort of particular, I suppose, in lockdown, can you pinpoint anything that made you start to sort of ask these questions about, you know, is there purpose to my life? What about Jesus? Was it lockdown itself that provoked any of that stuff?
I think the time in lockdown would have played a part, but there wasn't anything in particular. I had been told not to look into Christianity, but I'd kind of kept doing that like behind closed doors because I just thought it was true, and it just seemed to come to a head with all the extra time in lockdown.
So how did you end up listening to Unbelievable? Because I suppose it's one thing to be having all these questions, but how did that lead to listening to Unbelievable?
I'm not entirely sure how I found it at the very start. I'm not sure. But it did. It was definitely useful. It put the Christianity I was looking into in conversation, literally, with the atheism I was living, if I was to be perfectly honest.
And what sort of shows do you remember sort of did you start coming across? Presumably these were probably YouTube videos you ended up seeing, was it?
Yes, I think to start with, it was the YouTube videos. I remember as a chemistry student, a lot of the science versus God conversations putting me on people's like John Lennox and his work. And I remember the unapologetic episode of like the emotional sense of Christianity, which was a different point of view than a lot of like the other topics, which was really good.
That's interesting. Yeah, that episode with Francis Spufford, we pulled that out as a sort of classic replay over the summer. So that's probably when you bumped into that one. It's interesting though to say you were kind of looking into this behind closed doors, as it were. Was there, you know, what was going on in the background? Was there a sort of general feeling in family or whatever that, oh, you know, we don't believe that kind of thing? What was going on there?
Yeah, there was a kind of feeling that it was almost dangerous and I could be being brainwashed, which in a lot of ways is really real. Like the idea of fake news, it's a minefield a lot of the time nowadays. But I was convinced that there was truth to this and that it was worth looking into. And I can only thank God that he led me to things that were gospel centered.
So was there something in particular, or was it a kind of just a accumulation of effects gradually leading you towards a decision, do you think?
I started looking into apologetics, especially over the lockdown period with Unbelievable and things like John Lennox and a lot of different things. And I think I always felt that there had to be something more. Like, oh, I have to just listen to so many podcasts or watch so many videos, which I think as an achievement, I've always been an achievement driven person. Like, nothing's ever enough. But when I first went to church, the thing that struck me by what the minister said in the first service was how simple the gospel was. That is what, like, when Jesus said it is finished, he meant it.
I mean, you very kindly communicated with me sort of, I can't remember exactly when, Hayley, but I think you'd sent me a message saying, hey, I've been watching some videos and I feel very drawn to Christianity, but I don't come from a place where I've got any real Christian family or friends around me, church or anything like that. And we were able to have a bit of a back and forth, Hayley. That culminated eventually in you saying, but I feel like I don't know what to do next. I'm living essentially as an atheist, but I feel this real pull for Christianity. I can't deny it anymore, almost was the way you put it. But tell us what happened next and you know, what that's been like since then.
Yeah, it's funny that when I spoke to the guy you got me in contact with, that was the first time I had spoke to somebody like in person about the Christianity I'd been looking into and how I felt about Jesus, which was kind of weird, but really it was the thing to do. And he gave me some pointers of I could become part of a course like Alpha or Christianity Explored or go along to a church, or eventually the thing to do was to give my life to Jesus, which didn't necessarily happen right that second, but it was a process. Yeah,
sure. I mean, you did end up going along to the church, and I guess meeting a few other people. This was while churches were kind of in a period where they could meet physically for a while, and that's obviously went on pause recently, but back to something like, you know, being able to meet under certain conditions. A weird time in a way to try and start going to church, because it's kind of difficult to do church at the moment, but that still, you had a positive experience when that happened, as I understand it.
Definitely, yes. Uh-huh. Especially being in a place where there were other Christians and I wasn't just seeing them on a screen, at least not most of the time. And it did, hearing that first sermon did consolidate in my mind that this was my life. This was true. Yeah.
And did that sort of culminate in a sort of decision of sorts at that moment? What happened?
Yes, I think afterwards we did pray, and I think it had been an accumulation of all the searching over the summer. I made the decision that Jesus is enough, like what he did on the cross and the resurrection, that's true, and that is what I need as a sinner to be saved by grace.
I suppose you don't know any different, but what was it like becoming a Christian in lockdown? Because I guess it's hard enough when you become a Christian and you've got all these people around you who can answer your questions and can support you and can be praying for you and things like that. But it's quite another thing when obviously you got to go to church a little bit, but it's clearly not church as normal, really. And then there obviously were periods where you were, I assume, kind of watching online and maybe just communicating with people virtually. What was that like?
I suppose it might be different for people that have always went to church and seen that change. So it wasn't like I'd gone through a dramatic shift just coming in halfway through. And my church has done a lot of things on Zoom and a lot of online, which I'm so thankful for. If we didn't have any of this stuff, it'd be a totally different circumstance. But yeah, it is definitely strange. I would agree with that.
What has it meant in terms of you personally? Everyone, I think, who does make a decision for Jesus, it strikes them in different ways. Some people have some, whoa, amazing experience. Others are like, there was no big experience, but something changed in my life. I mean, what's happened with you, Hayley? What would you say is the difference it's made for you?
Well, I think in terms of like experience, that first time in the lunchtime club, after hearing the gospel properly for the first time, I did feel a peace that I couldn't understand or explain. And I think when I went along to the first service, there wasn't any particular magic or anything, but just slowly you can see my attitudes have changed and just a joy, a peace, a wholeness that doesn't come from like me and my, yeah.
And I would say that will be a lifelong journey. I mean, I can trace my beginnings of my, you know, faith back to when I was about 15. And I did have a kind of wham bam moment, but by no means is the journey sort of finished at that point. It's a constant journey of growing in Christ. But we're just thrilled that Unbelievable played some small part in this journey for you, Ailey. If you don't mind me asking, you said your family are pretty non-religious. How have they responded to all of this?
It's kind of depended. One of my family members I've actually recommended the podcast to, and they've started listening to it, and I've really enjoyed hearing that Christianity can stand on its own two legs, and just hearing the different opinions was really useful to them. Other members are very much of the opinion of we need to get rid of all religion, and very much like atheists, having seen a lot of fear and guilt coming from religion, and that's really impacted their view.
Ailey, this is our Christmas show. I guess there's two questions here. One, what's it going to be like being a Christian at Christmas? Because this is the first time you've ever experienced that. And I suppose there's going to be lots of interesting conversations around the Christmas table. And then I guess the second question is, as a Christian, what does Christmas mean to you now?
Yeah, definitely starting to see the meaning behind Christmas and behind the presents in the Christmas tree. In our Christian Union, we run impact groups, and we just looked at the Christmas story and just seeing how strange but incredible the Christmas story is, and how we quite often forget that. And I think having more time, maybe in smaller groups this Christmas, we might have more time to think what it all really means.
Ailey, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you. We'll keep in touch, obviously, because we'd love to hear, you know, how things keep going. All the best as you navigate both university in these current conditions, but also starting your Christian journey as well. But it sounds like you've had a great start. I'm so glad that we've been able to connect you with church and Christian friends where you are. And God bless you, and have a very happy Christmas.
Thank you very much. You too.
That was Ailey, who is a student in Scotland, and we're going to be hearing another person's story in the next part. We're also going to be hearing more from Nick Page, talking about his highlights of 2020 and what he's learned through lockdown. So don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to this week's Christmassy edition of Unbelievable. A little bit different today, as Ruth Jackson and myself, Justin Brierley, bring you some highlights from the past year, plus some interviews with interesting people. We're also going to be announcing the winners of our long-awaited book giveaway competition, which celebrated 15 years of Unbelievable on air on Premier Christian Radio. So look out for those who are winning signed copies of Unbelievable book, plus some books from my personal apologetics library. That's still to come. But right now, we're going to be listening to an interview that Ruth and I did just recently with Jim, talking about his own story of deconstructing and reconstructing. You may remember we did a show not that long ago on conversion and deconversion, and Jim got in touch with us after we aired that show with his own really interesting story.
Well, we're here with Jim Thring, who has got a fascinating story. Now, Jim, you grew up as a Christian and then became, you said, a sort of fairly ardent humanist atheist for best part of 10 years. And then you've come back to faith. Obviously, we've not got loads of time to go into the intricate details, but just tell us a little bit about how you started off as a Christian and I guess what it was in particular that turned you away. And then we'll talk a little bit more about what you brought you back again.
Well, without making the story any longer, a slight correction. I wasn't brought up a Christian. I was brought up in a household, it was a very loving household in the east side of London, and knew very, very little about religion and the Christian faith. So I was quite ambivalent towards religion and faith in general. I was neither here nor there. To be honest, I wouldn't have called myself an atheist either. And I became a Christian at university at the age of 19. Almost accidentally, you could say. Too long a story to say now, but I met some Christians at university, and one of them had a guest in a room in Halls of Residence, and she was talking about various things, and I'm afraid to say, looking back, I did get a bit lost. I switched off a little bit, and she kept talking about this place called Mingy's Hill, and it was a sunny afternoon in the summer term, and she said, would you like to come? We're all off there. And I said, great, because it sounds like a really nice day to go for a walk. And then I found myself sitting in the back of her car talking to my friend Ian, and asked him about this hill and what it was like. And he just looked at me incredulously and said, it's a a church. Muse Hill is the name of a church. So I accidentally found myself in this situation where I kind of felt two things, really. On the one hand, it's like, how on earth have I allowed myself to go to church? This is ridiculous. And on the other hand, I thought, well, actually, it might be quite interesting to go. And I did. And again, a long story short, just started to ask questions about life, about life's purpose. I was at university, so I was thinking a lot about what would happen after university. And the big kind of questions came up. And looking back then, it felt, my initial kind of feeling was that it was like being a child again, that I had a chance to do life a second time around, a second chance. And I became a Christian at university. And, you know, when I say became a Christian, people have asked since, obviously, further down the story, I did lose my faith. People do say, were you really a Christian? And the answer to that is yes, I absolutely was a Christian, in as much as anyone can say that they believe in God and they followed Jesus. This wasn't a nominal Christianity. It wasn't something I inherited from my parents. It was a decision that I made. And at that time, assumed that I would live that for the rest of my life. But obviously, things turned out slightly different along the way.
So what did happen? What was the kind of trigger, I suppose, that started you in a journey of deconstruction, for want of a better word?
Well, it didn't happen overnight. You don't suddenly wake up one morning and say, I've now changed my mind. There were a number of things that happened over the course of, I think, a few years. I could probably best describe it as a summary would be that my faith became more about what I knew and how much I knew than who I knew. And to kind of break that up a little bit, I think that what happened over time was that, you know, you're faced after university with real life. University is great. The Christian Union was very strong. And I did carry on with my faith for a number of years. But I think I was faced, like many people, with the kind of ups and downs of real life. And I think what happened was that I started to compartmentalize my life. I think that's what started to kind of come apart, was I was very much a Christian and very much doing the Christian thing when I was with other Christians. But I kind of grappled with, I guess, something that all Christians grapple with, which is that kind of exclusivity. You know, you're working alongside people who aren't Christians. They seem like very nice people, good people who are doing things with the best intentions. And I think that over time, you know, there seems to be this kind of struggle with, you know, this kind of dual life, if you like. I was kind of, it felt like over time I was leading a different life as a Christian to that I was leading outside of the Christian faith. And I think the other thing as well is that simplicity of the gospel, the simplicity of that message that I received when I first became a Christian, and the uniqueness of Christ and the uniqueness of the Christian message, just started to get lost. And my faith started to become a bit more pedestrian, really, and stagnate somewhat. And so when you kind of add these layers together of a faith that just becomes a bit monotonous, the struggles that you have intellectually, that they're also kind of there. And, you know, a faith that's less about a relationship, all these things kind of in the mix become a bit of a recipe for, you know, the potential to deconstruct. And I think really it's when those intellectual questions come into that, that's the kind of the real catalyst, is that, you know, you're then at this kind of critical point where you really start to think, actually, the way I summarized it in my mind a few years ago was that if God stops meaning something to you in your day-to-day life, the next logical question is, then why carry on believing? And that was what happened.
And you joked with us earlier before we started recording that when you lost your faith, you did it properly. So what do you mean by that? Because obviously you spent the best part of a decade as a non-Christian, as a humanist atheist, you'd have called yourself. Yeah. So what did that look like compared to what your life looked like before?
Well, I think, you know, I probably am somebody who goes with his convictions. I wasn't very public as a humanist. I didn't engage a lot one-to-one with people, but I really did. When I left my faith, I kind of went the whole hog. You know, I was quite hardline, to be honest, and probably quite defensive, actually. I was very defensive towards Christians. And I kind of took this view that, you know, I know the inner workings of evangelical Christianity, so you can't pour the wool over my eyes. You can't fool me with your bring and buy sale or your lunch or something like that on a Sunday afternoon. I know that you're probably trying to kind of, you know, pull me back through the door that I've just kind of walked through. And that was how I felt at the time. So probably a bit defensive and very much took a hard line. I liked to consider myself an honest atheist, in that I wasn't one of those atheists that kind of, you know, I didn't backslide slightly. I didn't kind of take this dual position of, well, I still think that there's this kind of objective morality or anything like that. Mm. I just thought, no, if you're an atheist, then you ought to be a materialist atheist, you know. And I really did kind of ride the wave of the new atheist narrative, really, especially because at the time that I came away from faith, it wasn't because of the New Atheists, but I discovered the New Atheists around that time. And so, you know, went to a book signing. Richard Dawkins was debating Professor Robert Winston, I think his name is. And, you know, I queued up and got my signed copy from Richard Dawkins. And, you know, and I thought, this is it. I've kind of seen the light now, and I've put to bed all those kind of fanciful ideas of faith. And that was what it was like. I think, you know, that first kind of phase, I like to think of my atheist years in kind of two parts, really. The initial sort of hardline, very defensive kind of stage. And yeah, there's a comedian called Jimmy Carr, who is a British comedian who does 9 out of 10 Cats and QI and various other things. So I think he's been public about the fact that he had a faith in the past, or he was brought up a Christian, something like that. And in one of his comedy sketches, he said something like, you know, when I was a child, I used to believe in an invisible friend who granted me all my wishes, and then I stopped going to church. And I kind of laughed at that, you know, kind of very knowingly, you know, yeah, that's right. That's kind of where I am as well. And of course, you know, looking back, what I realise, of course, is that thinking about that now, if you went to a church and that was the picture of God that they gave you, that he was a best friend, an invisible friend who grants you all your wishes, well, then no wonder you kind of would leave a church like that, because a Christian, you know, God is so much different to that. But that was kind of the kind of hard line that I took, really.
What did this all mean in terms of your relationships? I guess you'd done a lot of your life as a Christian since, you know, university times, and then that change. Did that impact people around you as well as obviously your own journey?
Yeah, it did impact relationships. My wife and I were Christians when we met and we got married, and we, you know, we saw ourselves as married under a covenant of the umbrella of the God who we both believed in and wanted to bring our children up in the Christian faith. And so we started out that way. And so, yeah, the biggest challenge was my marriage. And some people will think, hey, what's the big deal? You know, believing in God is just like going to a chess club or having a political opinion, whether you're conservative or liberal or something like that. And of course, it's not really, because, you know, these are heart matters. These are very personal, they're very emotive. And understandably, the big question that was on my wife's mind was, well, what does this mean? Does this mean that you don't want to stay married? Does this mean that you want to live a completely different life? You know, and how does that play out? So that was something that we both worked on together. I was very keen that our marriage survived this and that we found a way to keep doing family. My wife she had a very good mix of being very gentle, but at the same time, she was very clear that she still believed. And she was also very clear that actually, I still want to take my kids to church. And I didn't resist that. I didn't kind of insist. I think rather arrogantly, I thought, don't worry, I'll get them some way. You know, you can take them to church, but, you know, I'll find a way to get my views across or something like that, more surreptitiously, maybe. And I think I was also, again, probably a little bit selfishly, I was very keen to make sure that the Christian friends that I had and Christian family and my wife, you know, didn't perceive the step that I'd made as some kind of, you know, I've now decided to do life my own way. And that means that, you know, there's no bar to anything. There's no limits, there's no boundaries. And certainly didn't want to be the one that would be kind of to blame for a family breakdown or anything like that. So I was very keen to make sure that we kind of rode this challenging kind of period that we had.
I mean, obviously the story goes on, and yeah. You came to a point where you changed your mind again. Interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
So tell us about sort of what led you to start reconsidering the secular humanism you'd sort of embraced by this point. I'd be interested in hearing especially about any particular issues that maybe caused the deconstruction, and how you started to, you know, address some of those concerns as well.
Again, it didn't happen overnight. I think what started it was I think I softened from that hardline atheist humanist view that I picked up. You're aware I became a member of the British Humanist Association. And you have to bear in mind, what I share is my views, my thoughts. This isn't reflective of all humanists or atheists. But I found that whilst in the early years of being an atheist, I really did kind of ride those kind of the rhetoric of people like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and so on. And I think I kind of used that to keep justifying to myself intellectually that I'd made, you know, a very sound decision. I'd chosen to do life my way, and these very intellectual people can, you know, back that up in some way. But then I found that a lot of the narrative that I was listening to, either, you know, online or on Facebook, you know, social media, that kind of thing, I started to question it. It started to get some of the content started to get a bit pokey. and tended to put Christians down as people who weren't thinkers, who weren't rational at all. And it almost kind of felt like, if the church says this, then we're against it, you know, or if Christians believe that, then we're against it. And I just started to feel that actually, you know, I was remembering Christians that I knew from years ago, people who were a lot smarter than me, who I knew were still Christians, who still kind of stood by their faith. And I started to kind of feel, actually, I don't quite feel as strongly about that anymore. I feel a bit kind of softer, and perhaps it's not quite as straightforward. And I think that led me to a period where I realized, and this is probably the key thing really for me, I'm not a brilliant apologist. I don't have, you know, I'm not full time in that kind of space. And there are people who do a much better job of particular arguments for the Christian faith. But for me, the one thing that I really felt clear about was that reason and logic and rational thinking are not tools that are only available to the atheist. And actually, they're not things that you know, mean that you're obliged to follow that path and it will ultimately lead to atheism either. And I think that was the key thing, really, was that was the kind of what I'd taken on as a very strong atheist, was this kind of, you know, you can dismiss anything. Let me give you an example where Derren Brown, I think, is again known as a former Christian. And he did a program called Messiah, I think. I didn't actually watch it, but I think it was in the 2000s, late 2000s, where he talks about the power of belief and how, you know, the belief is a very powerful stimulant to, you know, to drive you down the particular track. And I used to kind of think, yeah, that's right. That's what belief was. That's what I went through. And I'm now free from that. I think what I realized that actually, you know, my atheism had as much of a powerful belief behind it. You know, the maxim that for everything there is a materialist explanation for it is also a very powerful belief, because what it means is it doesn't matter what evidence someone puts in front of you. It doesn't matter what arguments, however well constructed they might be or how valid they are, you've got a reason to dismiss them. And I think I started to try and be honest about where my atheism lay and what supported that, and kind of reconsider it again. And so, yeah, so there was that, and a number of different things happened on a personal level that made me just, you know, I met with Christians a bit more through my wife. She went to a different church by this time and invited me to some social events. And, you know, no one was too pushy with me, but it was just nice to kind of just to meet with people. And I think that softening gave me a, you know, sort of laid the groundwork really for me to think, actually, you know, maybe I could look at something new, look at some of these arguments for Christianity and see if there is defense. And so I surreptitiously, without my wife knowing, used my Kindle to look up somebody who could help me through some of the questions. And probably the biggest thing for me was origins and evolution and young earth creationism. It's more the science thing really that I think was kind of my thing. And I came across this man called John Lennox. I was really, it sounds funny to say it now, I was very keen not to to read a book by somebody who was a Christian institute or an American Christian, in quotes, university. I thought, no, I want to read something written by somebody who is a respectable university. And John Lennox is a professor of mathematics at Oxford. So I thought, hey, he'll do. And I read this book called Gunning for God, How the New Atheists Are Missing the Mark. And it was just really interesting because he started to address some of the things that, you know, that some of these kind of arguments that I'd thought were really knocked down arguments against the Christian faith. And I think what he did was he just turned it around. There was a very kind of clear pattern to me that some of these arguments against the Christian faith, you could actually turn them around and say, actually, source of the goose is source of the gander. You know, you can apply that to atheism as well. And a number of other things were happening alongside that. And that was part of that journey, the beginning of that journey.
And do you feel like the faith that you now have is quite different from the faith that you had in the first place? Do you feel like that kind of journey of deconstruction and reconstruction has actually made your faith stronger, more different, or does it look kind of similar to the way that it was before, but with a stronger foundation?
Yeah, I think what you said at the end there, it's yes and yes. It's yes, it's the same faith that I had when I first came to Christ. It's almost like that first love that you discover when you, you know, you first encounter God, you first encounter Jesus. But it is different in having come through this experience. I feel like, you know, I've been able to take time to reflect on why I deconstructed or deconverted, however you want to put that, what the reasons were. And I think that my faith now feels stronger for the fact that I can see that there are personal reasons why I'm a Christian. And I think if people are honest, there's always a personal reason why we have these convictions. If you're an atheist, you know, it was the same thing for me. I thought that my reason for being an atheist was purely intellectual and I could rest on that. But I think it took time for me to realise that actually there were personal reasons why I was an atheist. But now my faith is as strong, if not stronger, than it was before. You know, I feel that it's defensible. Having discovered Christian apologetics, I think Christian apologetics is very good at helping people to unblock those artificial barriers to faith. But I think it's also really good at helping Christians to be encouraged in their faith. That, you know, sometimes you're never going to know the answer to every question, and you're never going to amass all knowledge. It's just not possible. But there's enough there that you can kind of take a step back and see the big picture. A little bit like those, you know, those magic eye pictures that, you know, if you stare at this pattern for long enough, but you don't look too much at all the details, you just look at the whole thing and you relax a little bit. Mm. Eventually you see the image come clear and you see there's a 3D image there. And that's what it's like for me at the moment. That's how I would say my faith is.
I'm assuming your wife and so on, they were glad to see you come back. I'm sure they'd been praying as well in the background for quite some time.
Yeah, there've been a lot of people praying for me. I think when I left faith, I was probably a little bit resentful of that. Because I knew that they would be. I knew they'd be praying for me. I thought, well, you can go ahead and pray whatever you want to do. You know, I've made my decision. I'm doing life my way. My wife prayed for me all throughout. And the great thing, there is a very quick story. A great thing as well is I did mission for a year after university with a chap called Philip, who I hadn't spoken to for this whole period, for nearly a decade. And he was doing a doctorate in New Testament studies in the States. And he had a dream, and I was in this dream, and he's one of those people that's not prone to exaggerate at all. A really lovely guy, very British, so British that even British people think he's very British. And after he had this dream that wasn't very specific, he just felt a really strong sense to pray for me. And he did so every day. And I got in touch with him after I came back to faith and told him, shock horror, I actually left my faith 9 years ago and I'm back, you know, sorry to kind of bring all this to you. And he emailed me back and said, actually, I knew you'd fallen away and I had been praying. But, you know, apathy sets in over time until I had this dream and I prayed for you every day. And I found out that the moment that he was praying for me every day was the moment that I started to consider God again. So, you know, wow. The timing of that was extraordinary.
That is pretty amazing. The fact is, I know lots of people who are still in the position you were in, Jim. Mm. So we had what prompted actually your email to get in touch with me was because you'd seen a couple of the episodes we've done recently, people like John Steingard, his story of deconstruction. Now, John is sort of, I think, on an interesting journey and still yet to kind of make his mind up about where he might end up landing. We also did an interesting subject on deconversion and conversion stories as well. But just personally, I know lots of people who are in what you might call mixed faith marriages now, because maybe they both started out as Christians together, but one of them lost their faith along the way. Quite frequently, I have to say that is often the husband, maybe going on a similar journey that you've gone on. And that I know can cause a lot of difficulty in a marriage, because obviously that is quite a, as you said yourself, it raises all kinds of issues. Now, in most cases that I've seen, people have managed to kind of get along and, you know, just keep going. But what would be your advice, I suppose, especially for both partners in a situation like that, having been in that situation for some time, how do you make it work? What would be your advice for either party in that?
Well, again, this is only based on my experience, and everyone's experience is different. People's characters and relationships are different. I think, speaking from my own experience, it's probably a case of trying your best to discern where the other person is at. Liz knew that, you know, especially early on, that I wasn't really prepared to have a conversation about faith. And I think, you know, the Christians that I knew at church who, you know, who I'd left, they were very careful not to push too hard and not to kind of, you know, box me into a corner, if you like. But they just continued to stay connected, you know, to continue to love me and to respect the position that I'd taken. And that was really important because it gave me breathing space. And I think probably the advice I'd say is just stay connected, because once, you know, if you go too far, if you push too hard, then you lose that connection, then you've just got an uphill kind of battle really to kind of get that connection again. I think the other thing is to you know, respect opinion, but to stick by your convictions as well. You know, again, the Christian faith is defensible, and it's right that we ask questions and difficult questions. And I think if, as Christians, we can demonstrate that, you know, we don't shy away from the difficult questions, we tackle them, I think that's really important. And then if you feel, you know, that there's an opportunity to raise questions of your own and to demonstrate that actually atheism has a faith element to it as well, you know, the burden of proof isn't just one-sided, then, you know, maybe you can kind of introduce those things. But I think you just have to do it really carefully. I think you have to remember that the big thing here is relationship and time and breathing space. And of course, from my own experience, I can say, don't stop praying. You know, this isn't just about what words you speak. It's about your prayer and your support as well. Not to give up and not to assume, you know, I think in my email I said, I remember having a conversation with a friend. And I always had interesting conversations with people who'd never been Christians before, because I almost kind of felt, well, you just don't get it. You just don't get how critical this is and how important this is. And you're just ambivalently going through life without realizing this big debate, you know, between atheists and Christians. And I remember I was having this conversation with someone and he said, well, you might change your mind. You know, one day you might come back to faith, mightn't you? As if it was like a really kind of simple thing. And I was just like, you're bad. You know, of course I can't. How can I come back to faith? The toothpaste's out of the tube. You know, I've pulled back the curtain and seen the little man behind, you know, like in The Wizard of Oz. You know, this is ridiculous. There's no way I could come back to faith. And so I guess my message to a skeptic or an atheist who's in this position is, you know, of course you're going to feel that you can never go back. But you have to be honest with yourself and think, well, why is that? It, you know, what are the personal reasons for the position I take, not just the intellectual reasons?
This is our Christmas episode, Jim. You can see Justin's got very Christmassy lights behind him. I've got an array of crackers and stockings and things like that. I suppose the stuff that you're saying there about talking to skeptics and being respectful and things like that is really helpful for conversations that people might have around the Christmas table. But I guess I'd love to know, did your opinion of things like Christmas and Easter, did that dramatically change when you became a humanist and then sort of when you switched back? Did it take on that whole new meaning again of actually there's the deeper meaning to Christmas and things like that now that you've come back to faith?
That's an interesting one. I think I'm trying to remember how I approached Christmas. And I mean, Easter is one of those things that, you know, you just take the bank holiday, don't you? and that's fine. Christmas is one of those things where, you know, I probably felt that people at work who aren't believers, who aren't Christians, who don't have faith, they celebrate Christmas in whatever kind of way, or Hanukkah or whatever, you know, depending on, you know, your religious background. And I think I just kind of did the Christmas festivities and probably just took on the same approach that a lot of people have, which is just, it's just a historic festival. And it's not Christian anyway, you know, and all this kind of thing. I probably just felt I was a little bit above it, as, you know, not in an arrogant way, but just that, you know, take it or leave it. It's just a chance for people to get together and have a bit of fun. I think when I came back to faith, you know, obviously these kind of things, you know, all resurfaced my, you know, my original faith that I had when I became a Christian at university. You know, rediscovering the uniqueness of Jesus, I think, is a big thing. I think some of the reasons why people get themselves tangled up in knots a little bit is because of just their view of Jesus, their view of God is too small. You know, if you treat the Bible like it's, you know, if you expect that God exists, and if God exists, then the Bible is like some kind of script that's been written by someone who's been possessed and their hands being kind of driven across the page, then, you know, if that's the kind of thing you're looking out for, then of course you're going to have struggles with what scripture says. And if you treat Jesus like, you know, you expect him to be some character out of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, then of course you're going to struggle with certain things. But actually, you know, it's seeing the uniqueness of Jesus, I think, is the big thing. And then when you've got the uniqueness of Jesus and you've got the uniqueness of the Christian faith, then immediately you start to realise that comparing God to Thor, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, thank you so much for sharing, Jim. And happy Christmas. And yeah, you're writing a book about your story, aren't you?
Ever so slowly, painfully slowly. But yeah, I really would like to write a book because it helps me to, you know, consider what I went through, to reflect on that and put it down on paper. And also, you know, again, as I said, I'm not an apologist, so I'm not aiming to try and convince people of one thing or the other. But I do want to just kind of bring the personal experience to deconstruction and reconstruction. And hopefully that will be of benefit to someone.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story on the show today. It's been really, really interesting. And maybe we'll get you on the show at some point, maybe when the book's out, to do a proper discussion with someone who maybe hasn't gone on the reconstruction bit of the journey. But yeah, great to chat with you, Jim. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
You're very welcome. Happy Christmas.
That was Jim sharing a little bit of his story. So good to hear. And we've got lots more coming up in the next part of the show. We've got some highlights from over 2020, and we're going to be hearing a little bit more from Nick Page. So don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley, and Ruth Jackson, our special Christmas edition. And still to come on today's show, we're going to be looking back at some of the highlights from 2020. Later on tonight on The Profile, you can hear me speaking to Skip Heitzig, who's the author of a new book called Biography of God. And Skip pastors a megachurch out in the USA. So we'll be talking about what the pandemic of 2020 has meant for his ministry and about this really fascinating new book he's got out as well. So that's on The Profile tonight, also available wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you can come back for Unbelievable next week, the very first show of 2021 on podcast and on air, is going to be looking at J.R.R. Tolkien, The Lord of the Rings and Jesus. A fascinating discussion that I'll be hosting between two guests, Michael Jahosky and Holly Ordway. They're both experts on Tolkien, and they'll be talking about his Christian faith, his friendship with C.S. Lewis, and the way that Christianity actually permeates The Lord of the Rings in ways many people have never realized. So that's going to be a really great discussion at the same time next week. But excitingly, Ruth, I think we're ready to announce the winners of this big competition. I've been saying that we're going to be giving away 5 signed copies of Unbelievable, the book, 5 copies of books from my own apologetics library, which includes, by the way, that book by Skip Heitzig I just mentioned. And some Unbelievable DVDs we're going to throw in as well from past conferences. So are we ready to announce?
We are ready. This is very exciting. So the 5 winners, and I'm so sorry if I butcher any of your names, but here you are. We have got Frederick Buford, Daniel Seto, Ruben Martinez, John McAdams, and Sharon Bergman. So we will be in touch very soon with your prizes. And well done. Congratulations.
Well, 2020 was the year that none of us were expecting, was it, Ruth? I mean, what were some of the crazy things that happened for you in the past year? Obviously, we all had coronavirus, you know, affecting us in various ways, but you actually got coronavirus, didn't you? You got COVID-19.
I did. And I got that long COVID that seems to last forever and just sort of give you this horrible fatigue that seemed to not go away for months and months and months. But, you know, in the midst of all of that, there were some joyous moments. I got the most beautiful lockdown puppy who has given me so much joy. But yeah, it's been a crazy year for everyone, really, hasn't it?
Yeah, and not just because of the pandemic, though that in a sense has sort of been the filter that everything has happened through. We've also had, obviously, all of the fallout of the George Floyd murder, the Black Lives Matter, all the controversies that have gone on around that, the culture wars that have gone on, the US elections, which, you know, seem to take up just as much attention in the UK as they did the USA. And obviously, we've covered all of this in some form or another on the show over the past year. And both of our sort of jobs have changed, you know, to some extent. I mean, we're now both recording from home. Every edition of Unbelievable has been recorded from home since March when the lockdown began. If you can hear some beeping in the background, it's because the dustbin men, you know, are doing their thing. It's kind of like all of that's going on. But the kids, you know, have sometimes wandered in while I'm trying to record something or doing something live on air. It's all good fun. But it's, yeah, we've all had to just learn to adapt to unusual circumstances, haven't we?
Yeah, yeah. And I wasn't even working on Unbelievable at the beginning of the year, but I was avidly consuming all of the content that you were creating, and it's just a joy to be a part of it now.
Well, one of the silver linings has definitely been that circumstances have conspired to bring you on board, Ruth, which I've been absolutely thrilled by. So we've obviously worked together over the years, but it's great to be working together specifically on the show together. So look, let's cast our minds back to some highlights from the past year. And I'm going to go right back to the very first show of 2020, which was one of my favorites, actually, kicked off the year. This was Esther O'Reilly and Douglas Murray. Now, Douglas Murray, well-known kind of quite conservative figure, it's controversial sometimes as well. His book, The Madness of Crowds, had recently been published when we did this show. And he came on really to talk about that, but also his own sort of Christian leanings, even as an atheist. He described himself as a Christian atheist. And at one point in the show, which I think was maybe the most revealing, interesting part of the show, I did ask Douglas about what it would take for him to believe again.
I think I'd need to hear a voice.
What kind? A voice from beyond.
I mean it literally.
Okay.
By the way, I'm very interested in the absence of this sort of discussion within the religious discussion. Mm. I was having a very interesting late night argument the other week at Oxford University after a talk I was doing there. And we got arguing about religion in the early hours after, you know, a couple of pints of Negroni. And I said there to some religious people I was arguing with, have any of you ever heard voices and or had a vision?
Mm.
And I was very struck by the fact that the main thing happened was that one of them immediately flipped, said, I know exactly what you're trying to do. You're trying to make us fall into that trap. And then you're going to dismiss this whole thing and declare victory and we'll... And the reason I mention this is because I said, actually, that is exactly the opposite of what I was doing. I was inviting you to do the thing that will make you unexhaust yourself most swiftly. And I said to them, I've known two people in my life who claim to have had an actual experience of God like that. Not I've had feelings of, you know, or sometimes I feel X, but... one, both of them now dead, one who believed she heard the voice of God and wasn't a maniac by any means, was a very devout man throughout his life. And the other was a friend who became a priest on the basis of a vision,
right.
Basically, when he was a young man. And I just mention this because... as I mentioned it to these people at Oxford the other week, because it strikes me so vividly I would urge people not to fake it, needless to say. but it strikes me that that's not in the mix at all in what people are discussing about Western Christianity. I have traveled in quite widely in the Middle East, Africa, and elsewhere, and noticed that the... for instance, the churches in Africa, what I've just described isn't common, but it wouldn't be thought to be completely mad if you said it.
Sure. Yeah.
Whereas, and I mention this just because I'm interested in the absence of that. And when I say that, as I say, I assume that religious people will think I'm trying to lead them into some trap. I'm not. I'm saying that is and has historically been one of the ways in which the Christian religion has thrived.
That was Douglas Murray speaking on the first episode of Unbelievable from 2020. But 2021 has got lots of exciting things in store as well, hasn't it, Justin? Do you want to say a little bit about the next series of The Big Conversation that we've got coming up?
Oh, do I ever, Ruth? Do I ever? I mean, these things, you know, some things are still moving into place, so I don't want to kind of jinx anything, but we have got some really... if everything comes together, we've got some really exciting conversations on the boil. I can give you an idea of what's coming out. So basically, April is when we're looking to launch our next season of The Big Conversation. For those who don't know what that is, it's kind of just unbelievable with bells on, basically. We have some really big names, interesting themes, big speakers, debating some of the biggest questions in life. And we are going to be looking at the issue of AI for the first time on The Big Conversation. We've got some really interesting guests to talk about faith and belief in God. I think I'm safe to say some of these names, actually. So I'm just going to let the cat out of the bag on at least a few of them. Nick Bostrom is a well-known sort of in AI research, leads the Future of Humanities Institute in Oxford. We're teeing him up with Ros Picard from MIT, who's a leading Christian in the area of AI. So they're going to have a fascinating conversation. I'm really looking forward to bringing together Bishop Robert Barron, who's long overdue to be on the show, but such a huge Christian thinker, so influential, both through his YouTube channel, but generally in the States as well. Opposite cosmic skeptic Alex O'Connor is who we'll be bringing him into conversation with for the next season of The Big Conversation, plus some other big names, but I am going to keep them under my hat for now because we're still sort of tying down some of the details on those, but from very exciting conversations in the pipeline. Anyway, of course, The Big Conversation actually concluded at the beginning of 2020, our last season of that, with, again, what was one of the most popular shows we've ever put out. This was between Matt Dillahunty and Glenn Scrivener, which topped off The Big Conversation season two, debating whether atheism is good for the world. Why don't we hear a little clip from that? Because it's had so many views on our YouTube channel, many, many downloads as well as a podcast. And this was a really interesting moment in that conversation where they were debating whether religiosity is good for people.
I mean, one of the issues to throw into the mix is that there is a tremendous amount of public benefit for religions to flourish in societies. So when you look at the studies, you see that those who have an intrinsic religiosity, that is, those who identify as religion's the most important thing to me, it helps me to frame the rest of my life. If you ask those people on any kinds of measures of reproduction, how many babies do you have, longer life, are you happier, will you have more of a resistance to depression, to recovery from illness, recovery from surgery? Do you have a resistance to divorce, to suicide? There are any number of factors where an intrinsic religiosity, that is, a body of people who are saying that their religion means the world to them, those people thrive. In a world where if the government was able to put that into the water, if they were able to put a magic elixir into the water that could deliver those benefits, longer life, for goodness sakes, happier, healthier, they give more money to charity. They give more money to secular charities than secular people do. They give more time to secular charities than secular people do. They give more blood than secular people give. All these things have been demonstrated in thousands of studies. So you know, throw that into the mix as a government is looking at what will lead to the flourishing of society, what could make society better. Actually, intrinsic religiosity is something that could definitely do that. So,
first of all, you've got the issue of self-reporting. How happy are you? And we know, for example, especially from ex-Mormons, that groups like Mormon culture encourage people to, because they are representatives of the church, to present themselves as happier when less problematic. Mm-hmm. Now, who knows what the actual truth is there? And I'm not saying what the truth is. What I'm saying is there's an issue with self-reporting. There's also an issue with what is the real foundation here? Is it that they are religious, which, by the way, is independent from the truth of the religious proposition? That's why the challenge that I had for years was show me a real, true benefit of religion that is necessarily only produced by the truth of that religion. Mm-hmm. Because you can produce those same things with a compelling lie. If you've got five religions and only one of them is true, but all five of those religious individuals or people who are adherents to those are reporting that they're better and happier and these other things, then it has nothing to do with the truth of the religion. It has to do with who we are. Mm. And it may be the case that what people need is the community, which religions have done a really good job of building those communities. And it's one of the things that secular organizations are working towards doing now, building stronger communities. But we had to fight for just the right to exist and be open and talk about this before we could get to a point of building those sorts of communities.
That was Christian, Glenn Scrivener and atheist Matt Dillahunty discussing whether religion is good for you. That was the last episode of The Big Conversation in 2020, but we've got some very exciting big conversations coming up in 2021, so do watch this space for details about those episodes that are going to be coming up soon.
Yeah, absolutely. It's Ruth Jackson and Justin Briley with you here on Unbelievable, our special Christmas edition. And just in this section of the show, looking back at some of what has made 2020 such an interesting, memorable year, not always for the right reasons. Before we get to some of our highlights from shows dealing with coronavirus, issues around Black Lives Matter and such like, this was another little sort of gem in the year, Ruth, early on in the year. Brandon Robertson. While we were still able to do things like transatlantic flights, came over. He was doing a speaking tour. Brandon Robertson is a gay Christian who's a sort of very progressive leaning and well-known voice. And I managed to bring him in studio with David Bennett, who's also described himself as a gay Christian, but is from the side B, if you like, point of view, i.e. he has chosen to be celibate. He believes that's what he's called to as a Christian. They had just the most fascinating discussion on their different perspectives as Christians who both are same-sex attracted, both would describe themselves as gay, but living that out quite differently. So let's just hear a little segment of their conversation.
I just love Jesus Christ. I just want to live a fully self-expressive life under his lordship. I want to give myself fully as a gift to him. And I think for me, the notion that I have to embrace a gay marriage or gay relationship or even gay, you know, sexual expression to be fully myself is a betrayal of like what I see in that love relationship with Christ. And that's ultimate to me. And that's precious to me. And I just want to be able to have the right to have no shame about that, in a similar way to the way that Brandon's describing how other people feel as well. I think what we essentially have are definitions of what it means to flourish as human beings. And our culture doesn't have a very thick understanding of human flourishing. It thinks, I desire this, I get it, therefore I'm fulfilled. Instead of the Christian view, which is that you have to die to yourself and pick up your cross, and that that will then take you into resurrection flourishing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the place I want to land it, about being a disciple of Jesus, and that that actually leads you into true satisfaction, true joy, true resurrection. I think.
I mean, it sounds a lot like what you're saying is this is just as much a problem for heterosexual people, where we've been given this idea that finding your true love, expressing yourself in that way, is somehow going to give you this this wonderful life. And of course, most people find, oh, it turns out it's a lot more.
And then the other side for me is when people hear that I'm celibate, they think, oh, I'm going to put that on them as an ethic without any of that deeper story happening, and that I'm going to like oppress them with that. And that's not what I want to do. And that's how I get misunderstood. And it's quite hurtful when people say that. And so for me, it's really hard for the culture to understand the position I take because of its nuance.
And even the church, I know you've critical of the church that kind of idolizes heterosexual marriage, because Jesus was not married, you know, the person who found it.
And I'm critical
as far as you know, Paul, you know, one of the...
I'm also critical of gay culture that idolizes marriage in its own definition. I just think that we're moving into a time where 51% of the population is single, where we have to find ways of flourishing that don't always involve that my generation's exhausted. No one's really having that much sex anymore. Like, we thought this liberation front would free us, but I think Christ is going to attract more and more people because they're realizing that doesn't actually satisfy. And it's Jesus Christ who gives us abundant life, who leads us into what we're actually searching for in sex in the first place. It's the person that, you know, sometimes not the person in the pew, but the person going off and living lifestyles that are incompatible with the scriptures, that are often seeking God the most profoundly. They just don't know it. They're just, their desires are misaimed. It's getting that desire back into God and redirecting it towards life and goodness.
Anna Robertson and David Bennett on that edition of the show discussing side A and side B approaches to sexuality. If you want to listen to the full show, just go to the Unbelievable back catalogue. You can find it from the show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Lots of views of that as well on our YouTube channel. If you haven't checked out our YouTube channel, do encourage you to do that. We obviously did a number of shows dealing with coronavirus in some form or another, Ruth, around the time that lockdown started. We had AJ Roberts, Mark Sayers on, myself, my wife Lucy contributed to that one. Later on in the year, we kind of did a 6 month later catch up, which you joined us for as well, which was all really interesting. Sparked some interesting reactions, actually, because it did become, I mean, inevitably that the coronavirus, the lockdown and everything else became very politicized. And I was surprised at the strong reaction of listeners who felt that we were too, you know, towing the line, as it were, of safety and caution. And others who felt, no, we're you need to be more skeptical of the measures that are being taken, lockdown and so on. And yeah, it provoked a lot of strong reactions, which was quite interesting. But we've had a number of other shows. Obviously, we're going to come to one that was very, very popular in the schedule as well, on critical race theory between Neil Shenvey and Russell Berry. But tell us about the John Steingard affair.
Yeah, so John Steingard has been on the show twice this year, twice in lockdown. So he first appeared on the show with Sean McDowell, the apologist, and they had just such an interesting discussion talking through some of the reasons why John Steingard has lost his faith. He sort of quite publicly lost his faith. He wrote a number of posts on Instagram sort of charting some of the reasons why he's begun to question his faith. He was quite famous as a Christian, the lead singer of Hawk Nelson, a Christian rock band. That was the first time he appeared on the show. And then we invited him back on again because one of the reasons that he didn't have much time to unpack on the Sean McDowell show, because they were talking about so many other things, was this problem of suffering, which was one of the key things for him. So then we invited him back on with apologist Emil Ewing, and they had this brilliant discussion about suffering. It was really compassionate and heartfelt. And I think at the end of the discussion, they both just had so much respect for each other. And it was just a beautiful discussion.
You know, I've noticed sometimes when people suffer, it seems to draw them closer to God. And sometimes it seems to drive them away. And I've wondered a lot about why that might be. And I do think that there's this propensity for us to always want explanations for things. And I think when it comes to suffering, that's one of the reasons why it's a hard question, is because there aren't easy answers. Do some people seek the explanation so much that they get obsessed with diving deep into these issues like I am? Or do some people, would they rather have the resolution of taking that answer that they're given and going, that's good enough for me, I'm going to go ahead and live my life? Does the goodness and the experience of life justify the suffering? And that's a really good question. And to me, I mean, the existential sort of approach to that is like, well, live your life in such a way that it's worth it.
It just struck me that John's gospel talks about Jesus saying, in him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind, of all people. And I guess for the Christian, we are offered the prospect of relationship with the source of life and an experience of life in this dark world, in the real world where all these terrible things that we've been talking about happen. But there's a sort of exquisitely beautiful prospect that a loving God does exist and has actually revealed himself in the person of Jesus. But you and I can experience relationship with him that Jesus describes as akin to being born, like coming to know God and experiencing that capital L life is like being born all over again. And if that is true, then life really is worth living in multicolor or multiple dimensions. And it is worth pursuing the question of whether that is actually true, whether God does exist and his offer of relationship with us. And I think that the fact that Jesus chooses willingly to suffer and to go through the most excruciating pain known to man in the ancient world, but also to identify with us, you know, the Old Testament calls him the suffering servant, that integral to who Jesus is direct experience of horrific pain and shame and abuse and betrayal and all of the different kinds of pain that we can go through. and that God's love is expressed and demonstrated through Christ's suffering. I think that's something really beautiful and something deeply true, both historically and evidentially, but also existentially, that it's a truth that resonates with what it actually means to be human.
It really was a great conversation between John Steingard and Amy Orr Ewing, and very complimentary, obviously, to the one he did with Sean McDowell a little earlier in the year. So do go and check those out. I've recently been on John's own podcast as well, by the way. And what I love about John is so open-hearted, still wants to explore this. He certainly hasn't closed the door on Christianity, far from it, I would say. So, bless you, John. It's been good to get to know you this year. One of the major issues, of course, of the year followed in the wake of the killing of George Floyd in the USA. Huge protests, Black Lives Matter protests that broke out in the USA and elsewhere in the world. All kinds of cultural debates generated by that, not least a particular term that not that many people, I think, knew of before 2020, but which came into common parlance, critical race theory. And so we debated this whole issue on Unbelievable. Russell Berry, who's a pastor of the Bridge Church out in New York, joined me along with Neil Shenvey, who's a leading critic of critical race theory. Here's just a little bit of the conversation that they shared.
If this was merely in the realm of the academy and theorists, we wouldn't really be having this conversation. But what's happened is, and again, how I discovered the term is in how many of my other brothers and sisters in the faith and of color have experienced this, is we're talking about George Floyd's being killed after his being knelt on for 8 minutes and 46 seconds and saying this is unjust, something should be changed, the law, you know, that we live in a racist society. And then we are told, oh, you have just been held captive to this ideology called critical race theory. And so now it's like, well, what are you talking about? I'm just trying to respond to the very injustices that I'm seeing all around me. And so I think that one of the differences that exists is that there are people who have theories about race. Like I said, they're uncritical race theories. And by the way, Neil, what I meant by that wasn't that, you know, you didn't have any kind of a concept of race as a social construct, but what I have found, and again, I haven't read, you write a lot, bro. So I haven't read it all, but in the aspects that I saw, there wasn't a full robust analysis of what is happening today and how that is influenced by this concept of race, both not just talking about slavery, not just talking about 50 years ago, but the very concept of race and how it used now and how it's intrinsically been tainted by these unbiblical, sinful patterns of thinking about humans and organizing humans. And so in terms of, So I just wanted to say, I'm only in this conversation because I'm being given a label that I really don't care that much about. And I really want the church to be talking about the death that is in the street, the disparities. COVID right now has a disproportionate impact on people of color, you know, in some places twice as likely to die as white people. We're seeing this across education, across, you know, healthcare, across, you know, just economics, every field. And it's like, that needs to be talked about. I would much rather have a conversation about that than I would about a theory that is amorphous and whatnot. But anytime you talk about that in many Christian circles, you are giving this title. So that's the dilemma of saying, okay, there are elements of this that resonate with me. But the last thing I'll say to that is that it resonates because the Black church was already talking about this over 150 years ago.
Just a clip there from that discussion between Russell Berry and Neil Shenvey. If you see much, much more that we could have played from that, but you can go and listen to it in full if you haven't yet. I think that took place back in October in our archive. So go and check that out. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can, of course, listen wherever you get your podcast from. Don't forget to rate and review the show. If you enjoy it, then it helps others to discover the program as well. What I love, Ruth, is basically every week people email me saying, I've just started listening to Unbelievable. And I just love it that people continue to, you know, we've been going for 15 years, but there are literally people who will start listening to the show this week and have all of that back catalogue available to explore.
Well, and we're starting to put out some of that back catalogue as well, aren't we?
So
every week we now have an extra podcast, which is a classic replay that we've turned around from the archives. So
exactly,
so there's lots to explore.
We're sort of dusting off a few of those forgotten gems from the past, because a lot of the content we do produce on Unbelievable is very evergreen in the sense that while a lot of, you know, what we've done this year has been tied very much to 2020, actually a lot of the issues and debates, you know, they're still just as relevant 10 years later. So go and check those out if you haven't already. If you're listening and you'd like to get hold of some of those classic replays, we're putting them out midweek on the podcast. Okay, final clip from 2020, Ruth.
Well, Justin, I think this is one of those evergreen clips that you were talking about just there. And it's between an atheist philosopher, Julian Baggini, and Christian author Sky Jatani. And they were discussing the age-old question of whether Jesus is just a moral teacher.
What I think is missing, but interestingly enough, if you do strip out that divinity and everything, is that with Christ, you have the possibility of ultimate redemption and salvation. So if you take the Christ out of Jesus, what you get is a call to be our best selves, to strive, et cetera, et cetera. But against the background, where ultimately we know life is finite, we often fail, the poor often don't get their reward and so forth. So you have a much bleaker picture, I think, without Christ as the saviour. And I think that's something that just has to be acknowledged if you're a secularist. I think that there is, you know, a lot of atheists like to mock what they call happy clappy Christianity, you know, where everything's lovely jumpy. I think there is a version of happy clappy atheism as well, though. Just, oh, don't worry, you know, God doesn't exist. It's fine. Life is joyous. It's wonderful. Well,
as the Atheist Bus campaign said.
Yeah,
the Atheist. Stop worrying and enjoy your life.
That's right. So we're from both the UK, and there's this famous post on the side of a bus. It said, there's probably no God, which is a good start, because they said probably, you know, a bit of humility there. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. I think that's just so, that was so glib. I think that's a real mistake. Things are bleaker if there's nothing to save us, to redeem us. You know, be the perfect. There is no God to help bridge the gap between our imperfect selves and what we most strive to be. And that's, I think, that's a challenge for the secularist and the atheist, to sort of live with that somewhat bleaker outlook.
And I really appreciated that intellectual honesty in your book, that you admit at various points where the teachings of Jesus don't carry the same strength and bite when you take away those dimensions, and that you wrote the book in dialogue clearly with many Christian theologians and leaders and incorporate that in. As far as I'm concerned, as a secularist atheist writer trying to grapple with the teachings of Jesus, you did a brilliant job and a far more respectful job than others who have just tried to dismiss the teachings of Jesus as ridiculous. In that regard, I think it's good. Again, as I said earlier, you can do that. The question is, should you do that? If you believe Jesus is a brilliant moral teacher on all these different fronts, but the things he claimed about himself or the nature of the world or the nature of God are ridiculous and should be dismissed, that's where I think it gets a little bit more in line with what Lewis said, which is you can't cherry pick this and not that, especially when they are so deeply interwoven together in these documents that we call the four gospels.
That was Julian Baggini and Sky Jatani talking about whether Jesus was just a moral teacher. One of my favorite shows. They were just so respectful, so interesting. Definitely, definitely check that out.
Yeah, really substantive discussion. Both Julian and Sky are great. I particularly love Sky's podcast, by the way, if you haven't heard it yet. The Holy Post that he does with Phil Vischer and Christian Taylor. Final little snippet that will more or less bring us to the end of today's Christmas edition of Unbelievable. Ruth was sitting down to talk to Nick Page about Christmas. And here's a little bit about what he shared of lessons learned in 2020 and lockdown.
And this might be really difficult, but have you got any highlights from 2020, the year of strange things and coronavirus and being locked in your house?
Well, I suppose one of the highlights for me, and I wonder going into 2021, whether we will properly remember this or whether we will just sort of sweep it under the carpet, was that wonderful sense of community that we had in the first lockdown, lockdown 1.0, as we called it, not the later one, but, you know, that real sense of camaraderie and companionship and getting to know people and sort of sharing as we're all going through something. And hearing stories of goodness, you know, and church is doing wonderful things for their neighbourhood and all that kind of stuff. So I really hope that we can carry through the inventiveness, the creativity and the care from that time and, you know, maybe just be a little bit of a more compassionate society going forward.
Yeah, that would definitely be no bad thing. I suppose on a related note, are there any lessons that you feel like God was teaching you in lockdown?
Yeah, I mean, I do a lot of sort of retreat and reflection during the year, I suppose, and did a lot, really. And I think for me, one of the things was to actually step back a bit. I mean, I'm a writer and a speaker, you know, I do a lot of speaking. And of course, all speaking events were cancelled. And what I realised was just... With you know, due deference to all the people who come and listen to me, actually it was pretty wonderful because I could step back. And I think I need to have the courage personally sometimes just to say no and to trust in God a bit more and just to say, okay, I'm gonna take time back, because we all need to sort of nourish ourselves and feed ourselves spiritually and emotionally. And so I've learned the big lesson I think God's been teaching me a lot down is to rely on him more and less on my packed diary.
I think that's been lots of people's lessons, just sort of about, you know, relearning rest and Sabbath, hasn't it?
So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Sorry.
So if there's anything that you could take into 2021, any advice you could give to us as we head into 2021?
Well, I would say reflect, learn the lessons, think back, do not lose this time. You know, I believe actually these times of testing are a gift, a real blessed gift to us. I mean, very difficult, and I'm not trying to minimize anyone's loss that happened, but I think it's really important for us as a church, particularly going forward, to reflect on all we've learned at this time and to really not just sort of go back to normal. I don't want to go back to normal. Who wants to go back to normal? Normal's boring. I want to go back to new. I want, you know, resurrection, not resuscitation. That's what I want. And so I think that's what I'm really trying to do, and what I'm trying to do personally, and what I'd love to help others to do is, what have we learned? How can we go forward from this? And how is life going to be different?
That was Nick Page talking about what he's learnt during lockdown. And I'm sure lots of you have learnt lots of interesting things. Do get in touch with lessons that you've learnt along the way, your highlights of 2020, if that's even possible to say in what has been a bit of a mad year. But do get in touch with us at UnbelievableJB on social media or unbelievable@premier.org.uk if you want to drop us an email.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. It's been absolutely brilliant having you on board in the last 4 or 5 months for Unbelievable, Ruth, and looking forward to what 2021 will bring. Have a very happy Christmas and break through to the new year. You deserve it. You've been worked so hard this year, and I'm looking forward to having a bit of downtime as well with my family. And wherever you're listening from, we wish you also a very happy Christmas. We pray as well that 2021 brings good things. And if you're interested in joining us for our very first show of 2021, I'm kind of feeling like we need to keep the holiday spirit going just a little bit longer. So I thought, well, let's do something a bit different. Let's not start the year with a kind of high octane bare knuckle fist fight. Instead, we're going for something rather lovely and cultural. J.R.R. Tolkien, The Lord of the Rings and Jesus is what we're going to be talking about next week on the show. My guests are going to be Michael Jahosky and Holly Ordway, both of whom are kind of Tolkien scholars and fans. And we're just going to have the most interesting conversation on the Christian themes in J.R.R. Tolkien's works. And so look out for that on the show, same time next week. All that remains for us to say is happy Christmas and have a great new year. And we'll leave you just with a little snippet, something to enjoy this Christmas time.
Why was the turkey in the pop group?
I don't know. Why was the turkey in the pop group?
Because he was the only one with drumsticks.
Boom, boom.
What happens if you cross Santa with a duck?
I don't know. What happens if you cross Santa with a duck?
You get a quacker.
A Christmas quacker. Very good.
A Christmas quacker.
Okay.
What did Adam say the day before Christmas?
I don't know. What did Adam say the day before Christmas?
It's Christmas Eve.
boy.
But how is that funny?
Good question. Okay, what's your next one, Toby?
What do snowmen wear on their heads?
I don't know. What do snowmen wear on their heads?
Ice caps.
Okay, final one from Jeremy.
How did Mary and Joseph know how much Jesus weighed?
I don't know. How did Mary and Joseph know how much Jesus weighed?
They had a weigh in a manger.
Oh, happy Christmas, everyone. And a happy new year. Happy Christmas.
I wish you a Merry Christmas. I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.